Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us on our second podcast. My name is Diane Ivy, and today I have the honor and privilege to sit down with Barbara Seletsky to talk to her about her knowledge and years of experience of knitting. And I will just get started. Barbara, tell us, you know, a little bit about yourself. How long have you been knitting, and do you come from a family of knitters?
No, the only person in my family who was a knitter was my grandmother, who I absolutely adored. And we lived in this enormous house with 24 people. It was a huge dysfunctional family. And knitting was private time with my grandmother. So I watched her knitting. She was making bandages for this was in 1949. I was 4 years old. And I watched her making bandages for the soldiers in Israel, and I wanted to make afghans for my dolls, so I asked her to show me how to knit. And because she was blind, she couldn't really explain it, but she put her hands over my hands, and that's how I learned how to knit. So I've been knitting for, oh my God, 66 years.
That's incredible. That's really amazing.
God, I didn't think I'd live this long, but yes, it is amazing.
It seems like, so it's interesting, you said your grandmother, what was she knitting it for?
She was making bandages out of white cotton, very thin yarn for the soldiers. It was during the Israeli War of Independence.
Okay.
And she was doing that. She was one of the very few in her family who survived the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. She had come way before then, but there were eight. She had eight grandchildren and were all named for somebody who died in the Holocaust.
Wow.
But I always felt that I was the first one, the first grandchild, so I was her favorite.
It's great.
I really was.
You really were. That's always important. So I last time I did my blog podcast, I talked about this in the yarn industry, we have this lack of diversity. We don't see minority men and women that grace the pages of knitting magazines. You don't really hear a lot about knitwear designers or dyers of who are minorities, but there actually are out there. I know quite a few. So there's this level of like access to opportunity as well that come into mind when I was, you know, considering doing the podcast. And one of the reasons why I really wanted to interview you is because, you know, Boston is a Massachusetts or New England is a big hub for knitting. And I'm just curious about your experience knitting in Boston during your early years and how, what type of experience that was, not only just as a social aspect, but also on the level of like diversity. Like, how was it then? Or is there anything that's different then that you see now?
There was no such thing as a knitting group.
Really?
No, I mean, people would knit, but it would be a solitary activity.
Okay.
Basically, you could get yarn at Woolworth's, which was, I mean, it was crappy yarn. And there was a yarn store in downtown Boston called Bedford Yarns on Kingston Street. Mm-hmm. And that's where the real knitters, like myself, would go and buy yarn. And that was like my vice. You know, other kids would go to the movies or buy comic books. I would buy yarn. I had a stash at an early age. It seems to reproduce at night now. But it was not something that was a group activity. It was something you did in the evening after your homework was done. Because my blind grandmother taught me to knit, I can watch TV and knit, and I could even when I was a kid. And when I was in school, in a study hall, I'd have a book on the desk, and I would be studying, but I would have my knitting under the desk. It was one of those horrible desks where the chair was attached to the desk. And I would have my knitting under the desk, and I'd be knitting. But I would be studying. I knew what I was reading. But it wasn't something that you did in a group. And
I mean, how times have changed.
Oh, my goodness.
Everyone has a knitting group. You can belong to, like, 20 knitting groups. Maybe five. You're part of five. I'm guilty. I'm a part of it, like, seven. And I have a secret one.
But you'll have to share that with me
later.
I might.
But it's interesting that I always felt like it was, like, a big social thing. Like, during, like, World War I and World War II, they were asking people to make socks and stuff.
Yes.
Did people do that in a group?
Or and helmets.
And helmets. Knit helmets.
The balaclava helmets, where you could just see the eyes. Because
really?
It was cold in the trenches.
I did not know
I
that.
Still have
you
a,
always
I,
talked about socks.
Socks and helmets. Balaclava helmets, they
wow.
were called. And I know my grandmother used to work on them, but she couldn't do a lot of the decreasing and increasing. So one of my aunts, who was sort of like a closet knitter, but she was the most antisocial human being, but she would fix the helmets for my grandmother so that they came out mm-hmm. okay. But my grandmother would just do the straight knitting. And it was like, there was no such thing as a knitting group. I remember even going into, when I would go into Bedford Yarn, sometimes the person behind the counter would be knitting. Then when I was in college, the person behind the counter was me. But there was never the concept of a knitting group. It was just not something that existed.
Wow. That's amazing.
And very few of my friends were knitters. Very few. In college, I learned the rule, never make a sweater for a boyfriend.
That actually still exists.
Well, it's true. Trust me, it's true.
It still exists.
Although I had to make four sweaters for my ex-husband before I got rid of him.
Oh, yeah. So tell me about... So we talked about the yarn. You talked about Woolworths, right? It was like... I think... When I was a kid, like in the 80s, there was probably one Woolworth, or maybe it was, I forgot which, no, it probably was, that was still around.
There was Woolworths, there was Kresge's.
Okay.
And there was Newberry's.
Okay.
And they were 5 and 10 cent stores. Everybody I knew got their parakeets and their goldfish there.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get kitchenware, you could get anything.
Wow.
Notebooks. It was wonderful. You could go in there with a dollar and come up with two bags of stuff.
That's insane. I don't know if you can do that now in America. But,
not legally.
But you talk about now, I mean, I feel my grandmother, she actually never knitted or sewed or any of that. But she always talked about how things, you know, the cost of living has definitely changed. But the mm-hmm. quality, too. We talk about the quality. I would talk about the quality of clothing as far as, like, manufacturing has changed. In my opinion, and I... You're like, you have more knowledge on this, that clothes back in the day were fitted and made well.
And lasted longer,
right? And then you think about the yarn choice, though. I feel that the yarn choice then was extremely limited.
So limited.
It's so vast. I mean, that's like, it's almost like the reverse.
That's
you know, as a yarn owner, yarn dyer and business owner, I find that the level of competition is real. It's harder now
than
it probably was years ago.
Years ago, there was so little that was really quality yarn. The wool was itchy. The cotton, you would be knitting with it and pieces would fall off and it would go up your nose and you'd sneeze on your knitting. I mean, it was disgusting. And the acrylics, when I first started knitting, they were crap. I mean, they were just horrible.
When did you see the change, though? When did that change come?
Probably after I graduated from college in 67. And I had a marvelous roommate. We're still very dear friends. I was just with her in Maine this summer, and we were sitting knitting together. And we had the tiniest apartment in the world on Beacon Hill. And we used to sit on the sofa at night and watch the cat and knit. And she introduced me to quality yarn. There was a store on Beacon Street in Washington Square called Beacon Yarns, and they had the most gorgeous yarns. Unfortunately, the woman who owned it was not only a bitch on wheels, but a chain smoker. So everything you bought in there, absolutely. I mean, you had to air it outside
mm-hmm.
and wash it twice before you could knit with it.
You can't do that now, can you? You just can't be a chain smoker and have a yarn store.
Not really. They went out of business.
Or having pets. I mean, some stores have like a store dog or something.
But it's usually a short-haired dog.
Yeah, but you can't have a cat.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah. The standards have changed.
Cats have such attitude anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, in fact, there was a knitting store years ago in Brookline called Sheep's Clothing. And they had a little dog that was in there a lot. But I mean, the dog was like the size of a large rat. So actually, the size of a medium rat.
Okay.
But, and it was the most innocuous dog. I mean, it didn't bother anybody. Uh-huh. But yeah, you don't see pets in the stores anymore. But what you do see, and you never saw this in a knitting store, round tables.
Explain.
People will come in with their projects. And I see this at JP Knit and Stitch. I see it at other yarn shops. They'll come in and say, I don't know what I did here. What's wrong with this stitch? And somebody in the yarn store, either another customer or one of the people behind the counter, will say, oh, I see what you did. Let me show you how to fix it. That was unheard of. Absolutely unheard of.
So what do people do?
They would tear it out or they would give up knitting.
Really?
They had somebody who knew how to fix it.
So people would go into a store just to get the yarn and then...
That was it. It was a transaction. That was it.
Wow.
Now it's a relationship.
Wow. There's always... That's funny because we were talking to other people from the Sunday knitting group and there used to be... They would say, you know, knitting has become so popular now. And then you hear people say, it's always been popular. It's just that people were quiet when they were knitting. What is your take on that attitude of like, you know... Knitting was a pastime, and now it's just popular. And people say, like, it's always been popular.
I suspect that it always has been popular. It's almost like we're being outed.
Yeah.
Because it was something you did at home. Now, Thursday night, I went into town for a friend's retirement party, and I had my knitting with me, and I'm on the street on the Orange Line, and I look across me, and there are two other women knitting. And we kind of smiled at each other and laughed. And, you know, they said, what do you mean? I said scarf. They said mittens. You know, and it was kind of like camaraderie, even on the train. I mean, I'm never going to see these women again, probably. But it was nice. And I do it a lot at doctor's offices. I had a scarf a couple of years ago that Jennifer taught me how to make it from JP Knit and Stitch, God rest her soul. And I called it the Jennifer scarf, and I also called it the waiting room scarf. Yeah. Because if I waited for more than an hour, I had finished a scarf.
People
would say to me, oh my goodness, that's so pretty. You know, and I'd say, oh, it's so easy.
Yeah, you know. That's great. You have had so many years of experience at knitting, and you have a very cultural, like, historic aspect of Boston, but just how people lived then, now, and through your experience. And you mentioned before that you lived in Brookline.
Yes.
And going back to, like, when I talked about, like, diversity and what, you know, the issue for me is that, like, when I go to these trade shows and I do these large conferences, these national knitting conferences, I was surprised that I was the only African-American business owner.
I'm stunned.
I'm on the tail end of Generation X, beginning of Generation Y. Also, I'm the Oregon Trail generation person. I've been around more diverse people. Like, my friends are diverse. So
we,
like,
live in Boston.
I know we live in Boston.
It's the lunatic fringe of the country.
Yeah. But, you know, I think for me, it was a shocker that out of the 100 to 150 vendors there,
I'm amazed
that there were not more minorities represented. And if to say that our industry doesn't have a problem is an understatement. And people will say, well, we're more Black people crochet. And I said, well, hold on a second. The majority of people who work with yarn actually crochet. There are 53 million people in the United States who either knit or crochet alone. And out of that 53 million, there's a larger percentage of people that crochet. And they're not all African American. They're not all Latino. So it doesn't matter if you knit or crochet. It's yarn. And our industry is not representing the minority community, the LGBT community, in a way that's like...
Well, the LGBT community is a very quiet community.
Do you feel like it's quiet in the knitting world?
I think it is, and I think it's a shame.
You know what? I agree. I think that the LGBT community, as far as like gay men, they knit or they're designers or... But I still feel that it's very quiet. I think a lot of men also choose not to knit because they say like, oh, well, if you knit, then you must be gay. And then that's just
not
true.
You want to tell Roosevelt Greer he's gay?
You know?
I don't want to do that.
So, I mean, knit. And I mean, yeah. But the industry as a whole has diversity. But you growing up in Brookline, what type of community? I mean, Brookline now is a predominantly, what is it?
Everything.
Predominantly everything. How was it growing up for you in that community?
There were a few black families.
Okay.
In fact, I don't want to brag, but I was the only white girl that was allowed to jump rope with the black girls because I was that good.
Good. Well,
now,
hey.
Now I can barely walk, but I'm 70, so it doesn't count.
That is, you know.
But I remember, you know, to me it was just, as long as they weren't Germans, it was okay.
Was it predominantly Jewish in Brookline?
My area was predominantly mixed. Because okay. I was South Brookline is predominantly Jewish.
Okay.
That's where the rich people live. I grew up in North Brookline, in Brookline Village.
And Brookline Village is the...
Right near between Coolidge Corner and
the
village.
Was that like a
village.
Poor area at the time? Or was it like
was
a working class?
Working class. Okay. Definitely working class.
And it was a little more mixed, diverse community?
Mixed. Quite mixed. Mm-hmm. A lot of Irish Catholic people. There were some Protestants. Mm-hmm. It was mostly Jewish and Catholic.
Okay.
And, I mean, I went to my friends' churches. They came to my temple. It was no big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody was getting married or somebody's grandfather died and we went to the funeral, whatever religion they were, that was where we went to the funeral. And yeah. It was just no big deal.
Yeah.
Just, you know, this isn't what I do, but this is what you do, so that's fine.
Awesome. That's great. So one of the things we were just talking about this. Your granddaughter, Barbara, this tells you, I moved to Boston like 11 years ago and I met you at Circles. I moved in 2006. So I started going to Circles like 2007. I went for the New Year's Day celebration.
Okay.
And I think you were there. So it's just 2007. For 8 years I've known you, I think. Yeah. And, or 10 years or something. I remember your granddaughter being like in elementary school. And then you just told me she's 17.
17.
How time flies.
Doesn't it?
Right? And, you know, it's, one, it's a testament to our friendship. But
yes.
Two, Jordan is just an amazing young lady.
She is.
And she
totally
comes from two,
amazing.
She comes from one. She's one person, one world, but she has two different cultural upbringings, I assume, right?
Well, she has opted to be Jewish.
She's
that
an African-American Jewish woman, young girl, right?
We belong to a temple, thank God, where she is not... You look at a group of kids from that temple, you won't pick out Jordan. Mm-hmm. There are biracial kids, there are black kids, there are Asian kids... one of my best friends in the temple is Hawaiian. Uh-huh. I have a knitting group at the temple. We do charity knitting one Sunday a month, and we meet at each other's houses during the month. And there's two black women, an Asian woman.
It's a very diverse
temple. Oh, it's incredibly diverse. Jordan's bas mitzvah was with her friend, whose name is also Jordan. That was not too confusing. Who has two mothers, mm-hmm. and who are both deaf, and we had a signer at the bas mitzvah, and a lot of their friends are lesbians, a lot of their friends are deaf, and I mean it was deaf people, gay people, black people, white people, non-Jewish people. It was a great mix.
That's you know, and I feel, but that's just it. Like that's. You have the knowledge. I feel that that's what the yarn industry should be.
That's what the world should be.
It should be. And it's really difficult, you know, personally for me, and I know for others, who pick up a magazine, a knitting magazine, any publication, and you can't see. I grew up in Highland Park, Illinois. which is a predominantly Jewish community, okay. right? You're either Jewish or you're Catholic. I grew up in a very working class family. And I didn't see other people who were like me. I didn't see it even at the time as a kid in magazines. And I feel like we're heading into 2016. I still feel that our social media, our mass media, we're still falling behind on diversity. And, you know, yeah. I look, you talk about the temple where Jordan had her bat mitzvah and how beautiful that's like a lot of diversity right there. Yeah. And that's the type of world that, you know, I feel that we should strive to be in.
Well, I feel like my temple is a microcosm of what the world should be, mm-hmm. because it's just very accepting, very caring. There was one young woman in the temple who was carrying a baby. It was one of those things where it wasn't her egg or her husband's sperm, but she was carrying this baby for these two gay men in New York who were temple members. And there was such a celebration. Mm-hmm. When they came and they named the baby, it was just wonderful.
That's beautiful.
And I mean, who am I to say that because I'm white, I should have more privileges than you? Although, talking about the knitting magazines, I never noticed until Jordan was born. Because I would notice in the magazines, oh look, there's a black model. Or, oh, I think she's biracial. Whereas before, it would never occur to me, mm-hmm. and it's the way things should be.
So do you feel that since your granddaughter was born being biracial, that did it bring more awareness to you?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Although it came before that, because her mother and I have been close for years.
Okay.
From before she was born, because mm-hmm. she started going out with my idiot son when she was a teenager. Yeah.
You love your son, though.
No, right? I don't.
Oh, I'm sorry, Barbara.
No, not as sorry as I am.
So, but your son gave you beautiful yes. grandchild.
Yes.
So let's. I want to change the subject on something. Just
yeah,
a little
absolutely.
Bit. So Shelley, our dear friend Shelley, mentioned that someone in your family patented or invented
the little tiny flower. That goes in the middle between your boobs on your bra.
I mean, I think, okay, listen up. I think every woman I'm going to say every woman in America has probably gotten, if you had a training bra, you had the little rosettes.
What was the concept of a training bra? What were you training for?
I don't know, but they were called training bras.
Yeah, I remember.
And there, I remember those little rosettes. I do remember that. And I have known you for this long, and I didn't know you. Someone in your family invented that. It's a guy. You thought it would be a woman who maybe invented that. That's like crazy.
My Uncle Sam.
How is did Uncle Sam pay Uncle Sam for his idea? I'm assuming that he must have.
No. But he was a multimillionaire.
Wow.
You don't get an 8-room apartment in East Village with a doorman if you're poor.
That's insane.
But, yeah, they had a factory in Berwick, Pennsylvania. And one of his sons took it over, in fact. I think he's probably still doing it, or his kids are doing it.
So he did the bras? Or he did
no, just the thingy.
He just did that?
The thingy. He sold the thingy to bra people, to Warner's, to Bali. To maiden form. That was his big
Was he,
account.
So your uncle.
All he made was the little teeny weeny rosette.
And he was, did he grow up in Massachusetts or did he grow up
New York? Brooklyn.
Wow. That's like amazing. I never knew that.
It's very funny. His family, his wife and my mother were first cousins. And their family landed in New York and got the name Zublat. My grandfather landed in Boston and got the name Silberman, and another relative landed somewhere on the southern coast and got the name Seablatt. But they were three brothers.
Wow.
With three different last names.
Wait, he got the name? Did they
At immigration, at Ellis Island or wherever it was.
They never got the correct name right,
no,
did they?
No, it was Zublatt. Actually, they got it right once.
Wow. They must have been young. Did they not tell them, or did they just...
They didn't speak English.
Wow.
This was before, way before Nazi Germany. This was probably in the late teens, early 20s that they came here.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so
interesting. They were kids. They were basically 17, 18.
And they were like, we'll just keep it.
They were going to make a fortune. So they took what... You're desperate to get into the country. They give you the name, you know, Big Shit. You'll take it.
Barbara. So that brings me to something else. Like, we have this really big issue going on right now, topic politically about immigration. And one of the things that I talk about in the yarn industry is that the history of knitting started like in the Middle East. Like Stephanie mm-hmm. Pearl McPhee talked about it. And we most of our yarn comes from Peru, comes from South America. And if, you know, people say, well, immigrants are, it's too many, or, you know, we need to close them out or whatever. But I feel like our history has shown that, you know, when people immigrate to America, they really are looking for better opportunities for their families.
I would say 98% of them are.
And your family, and I feel like a lot of immigrants who come here look at it as an opportunity to start businesses, right? And I look at opportunity to start businesses to provide, so that their children can have a better education. And
I was with a friend Thursday night who came here from Cuba when she was 14. And they got here on a Thursday. Monday morning, her father had them all enrolled in parochial school. There were four kids. He went to work as a janitor at BU. Mm-hmm. So his children, who were in their early teens, she was the oldest, could go to BU for free.
It's amazing.
And they all did.
Yes.
Because his focus, coming here from Cuba, he knew he wasn't going to achieve his particular dreams. But his kids were, and they all did.
Yes. And, I mean, but that's just it. But, like, people come, like, you talk about your uncle, I mean, inventing something that every woman has worn, you know, and still wears.
Yeah.
And I think about the textile industry where a lot of immigrants have come in and built textile, I mean, anything, but textile businesses, or from being a seamstress to being a tailor.
Rag man.
What's a rag? What's a rag man?
Oh, they used to go through the down by Hester Street and down in the West End. I don't know how much you know about the West End. It's where Mass General is now, and that horrible complex of apartments. But it was like a village. It was called the Urban Village. And they used to go through with their horses, the dray horse, meaning drag, and the cart, rags, clothes, bottles, and people would throw out their rags and they would sort them out and wash them and resell them. And that's how a lot of people got into the textile business.
The textile industry, I had a board advisory board meeting a couple days ago, and we talked about angel investment for yarn industry, people in the yarn industry, mm-hmm. say textiles, and how that doesn't really exist. We're all into about technology or healthcare, which are important, but the textile industry is an industry that has been around for thousands of years.
More.
Yeah, right? And that our society, we need textiles in order to survive. And people look at me like I'm crazy, but it's like,
hello?
We need to clothe
what
ourselves.
What are you wearing?
The different areas that you live in, if it's cold, if it's hot, or if we use cloth, we use textiles to live.
Yes.
And we're now using textiles in medicine. And so with angel investment opportunities, there's a huge lack of opportunity for people like myself in the yarn industry to get angel investment.
Isn't that interesting?
And so, you know, there's a focus of like, well, what's the next major app that's out? That's, you know, it's that level. And so, or what's the next pharmaceutical drug that we can drug America with? So,
and like, then charge $1,000 a pill.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like I have read, and from like the things that you have said, our history has shown the impact that not only immigration, but people in America and around the world have had on our economy in the textile industry. But yet when we now in a very innovative entrepreneurial society, we're not given the opportunity to raise the type of working capital we need when to grow our business. When you say
we, you're talking about textile?
Textile business owners. Or, yeah. You know, we're not given the opportunity to, like, really pitch.
It's not seen as a necessity.
Yes.
It's not sexy. I think it is, but that's just me.
I do.
But, you know, drugs are sexy because, for one thing, you can become a multimillionaire. But there really isn't, I'm thinking about it, there's really no, the only ad I've ever seen on TV is for cotton. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Cotton underwear.
Cotton.
Just cotton?
Cotton. It has this girl wearing a pink and white dress, very pretty dress, and she says, this is my favorite dress. It's cotton. And then they're showing all these different people doing different things in cotton. So it's the cotton industry, mm-hmm. which I was like, wow, that's an interesting ad.
That's very interesting. I haven't seen it. I've watched TV, but yeah, well, I'm going to have to look for it now.
I'm a bit of an addict.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I'm Barbara, I'm really glad that you came over to my house and you were able to sit down and talk today. I guess I want to get your opinion, your wisdom. Seriously. What do you... To a lot of young people out there who either knit or who are starting a business in the yarn industry or textile industry, and thinking about your granddaughter, Jordan, like, what is your hope for the future in the yarn world and just the world in general when we talk about diversity, when we talk about access to opportunity, not just based on race, but gender and socioeconomics?
I would love to see the day when the word diversity is an obscure word. I think, you know, at some point, I'm hoping that diversity ceases to be an issue. It would be really nice if diversity were referring to different types of tomatoes or squashes as opposed to people, because I think we, a lot of times, and I think this is partly a result of immigrants coming in. I know my mother didn't speak English when they got here. She was 3 years old, and the kids in the, my grandmother put her in kindergarten, and the kids made fun of her. So she developed a shell. And I see that Jordan doesn't have a shell, and I don't want her to. I think that what's going to happen is that I won't live to see it. I don't even know if Jordan will live to see it, but I think at some point, diversity is going to cease to be an issue. At least that is my sincere hope. That, I don't know, I'd like to see a meritocracy. You know, if you're good at what you're doing, you do well. And if you're not good at it and you're lazy, you don't do well. It's not that hard an equation.
Yes.
I would like to see people going through magazines and not noticing if there's an African-American or an Asian or a Latina.
That it's already just there?
It's there.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I look at car ads. All I see is a red car or a blue car. I don't know if it's a Camaro or a Mercedes. It's a car. And I think people should be like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Barbara, I want to thank you. And the last thing I want to know is what's on your needles? What are you knitting?
This is the Sanibel cowl.
Okay.
And what happened was I had a terrible day yesterday. I spent it in the bank screaming at people. I don't like when I do that, but there I was. And so when I walked out, I was between a Brugger's and there was Gary's Liquors, which has a really good deli. And I thought, I could really use a corned beef and Swiss on dark rye with brown mustard and potato salad. And two cans of Dr. Brown's Diet Cherry, because if I'm having calories, I'm chewing. And I thought, nah, that's going to make me sick. I'm going to go buy yarn.
That is, and ladies and gentlemen, and that I will
It was close. Wine or yarn?
And the yarn we won. Choose wine. I mean,
yarn, choose yarn, yarn, yarn.
Well, Barbara chooses yarn. I might have to just choose the wine. It just depends.
I may stop and get some.
So thank you so much for listening to our second episode. And we hope to have you join us back in 2 weeks for our next one, which will be a surprise again. All right. Thank you. Have a good day. Bye.